Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin, and today on the pod, I got the pleasure to sit down with Destiny Lopez, the co-director of All Above All, which is a group fighting to restore abortion rights and abortion access with a focus on insurance and making sure all women have the financial means to access abortion care. We had a very wonderful conversation about the nominee of Brett Kavanaugh and what him on the bench would mean for Roe versus Wade and abortion care more broadly. Before we get to that, I have a little mini news block on Brett Kavanaugh, and then also I would like to announce a Hellion of the Week. I also just want to remind everyone that there will be no shows next week. I will be going to Comic-Con, and I am taking a little bit of a break. So unfortunately, I won't see you next week, but I will be back the following week with Varsha and even more guests. Okay, Hellions, let's talk about Brett Kavanaugh. He is, I don't even know how to properly shame him. He is the, I would say, just middle of the road, young Republican lawyer, judge, milquetoast asshole. But the thing is that he's not. He has spent 12 years on the DC Court of Appeals. He was nominated to that position by George Bush. And his confirmation hearing was a hot fucking mess. He needed two confirmation hearings, which is very rare. And then Senator Dick Durbin, after the fact, sent a memo saying that Judge Kavanaugh had lied to him in order to secure the votes needed to be confirmed to the position. And more than 30 senators voted not to confirm him. This really feels like Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III all over again when he tried to get a judgeship and he was blocked because people were like, no, you're a fucking asshole. And Coretta Scott King wrote a letter saying, this guy's a racist motherfucker and he cannot be on the bench. So we have another situation where this guy was not confirmed by a wide margin and, in fact, lied about his involvement in certain policy issues when he was working in the Bush White House in order to get the votes to be confirmed. He's also 53 years old, which means if confirmed, he could spend 40 to 50 years on the bench. That is generations of buffoonery for him to conduct. And that's just completely, completely unacceptable. Also, irony alert, this guy is from the DC Court of Appeals, which is very prestigious. And you know who the Chief Justice of the DC Court of Appeals is? Merrick Garland. So apparently that wasn't good enough for Mitchy Poo to even meet with him for possible confirmation. But nope, he just wanted to steal that seat. So anyone who says this guy is super qualified and wonderful, go fuck yourselves. So he's also a real messy bitch when it comes to abortion rights and healthcare rights in general. He is the asshole who wrote a dissenting opinion in Garza versus Hargan. Garza versus Hargan was the case brought by the ACLU that involved the undocumented teen Jane Doe, who was seeking to get an abortion back in October of 2017. So the court ruled that Jane Doe had the right to get an abortion and she would need to be given access to get this abortion. So Kavanaugh wrote that allowing the legal abortion that she was going to pay for would go against the government's, quote, permissible interest in favoring fetal life, protecting the best interests of a minor, and refraining from facilitating abortion. Okay, just side note, that phrasing feels like he's saying that he favors the fetal life above the life of the pregnant teenager, which it sounds like that because it's what he's saying. And second of all, it's such a crap argument because she was not asking for any sort of facilitation from the government. She was not asking the government to facilitate the abortion in any way. She had a means to get to the clinic. She had money to pay the clinic. She was not asking for the government for anything except for being allowed to leave government custody. And that's what this case was about. HHS and the Office of Refugee Resettlement, in particular, under the auspice of mega dickwad Scott Lloyd, was physically blocking her from leaving so that she could get this abortion. So it's just, if I knew nothing else about this guy, and the thing is there are pages and pages and pages of rulings and opinions and a whole bunch of bullshit. But if this was the only thing I knew about the guy, it really tells me everything that I need to know. He said in this dissent, quote, For minors such as Jane Doe, who are in U.S. government custody, the government has stated that it will not provide, pay for, or otherwise facilitate the abortion, but will transfer custody of the minor to a sponsor pursuant to the regular immigration sponsor program. So he's saying that the government can't facilitate abortions, and that's thanks to a very complicated precedent of things like the Hyde Amendment and other things that prevent government resources from going towards abortion care, which I just want to remind everyone, abortion care is medical care, which is legal in this country. So, you know, that's a bullshit argument. But she's not asking for any of those things. She's not asking for money or transportation or facilitation or support of any kind. She had the support independent of the government. All she was asking for was to be released from physical custody for an afternoon. So he's saying that it is not an impediment to force her to wait to be transferred to the care of a sponsor. So he goes on, quote, under the regular immigration sponsor program, an unlawful immigrant minor leaves government custody and ordinarily goes to live with or near a sponsor. The sponsor is often a family member, relative, friend, or acquaintance. Once Jane Doe is transferred to a sponsor in this case, the government accepts that Jane Doe, in consultation with her sponsor, if she so chooses, will be able to decide to carry to term or to have an abortion. And so now it's footnote time, bitches. There's the footnote to this. He says, quote, the minor, of course, also has to satisfy whatever state law requirements are imposed on the decision to obtain an abortion. And this is the important part, because this case was in Texas. In Texas, abortions after 20 weeks are illegal. So Jane Doe, at the time of this ruling, was 15 weeks pregnant. And it was very obvious that throwing up a roadblock, like transferring her to a sponsor in an, quote, expeditious manner, which what the fuck does expeditious mean? It's not like they said she has to do it in 48 hours. They didn't give any sort of guidance on that. It's that he was running the clock on her. He said, well, she can't do it while in government custody because of some bullshit facilitation rule, but she has to go to a sponsor. But it takes time to find you a sponsor. And so by the time you get there, you might be too pregnant to get an abortion. He's created a really elegant catch-22 that makes me want to punch him in the fucking face. And Hellbent does not condone violence, but I can still imagine it. So, that's the rub. He's running the clock on her. So I think this ruling, this opinion is also so indicative of his jurisprudence in general. Because what he does is he uses this sort of loophole-y, strict constructionist language to create boring-sounding but terrible hot takes. So he's creating these catch-22s. So he gets to be like, oh, it's not me, it's the law. But he's actually applying the law in a way that very much furthers his conservative ideology. And it's just such bullshit. And also, as Destiny and I are going to talk about, this also intersects heavily with the ACA and healthcare in general. And a couple of cases about the ACA have actually gone in front of Judge Kavanaugh. Seven Sky versus Holder and Sissel versus Health and Human Services in particular. And out of context, these two rulings looked like he actually was upholding the ACA. But in reality, he was just kicking the can. He said that what he was really concerned about was judicial overreach, and he didn't actually care about ACA itself. So it's really important not to take these decisions and these opinions out of context, because yes, he did rule to uphold the individual mandate in Seven Sky, but he did so because he felt that the judiciary should not get involved with what he called a tax matter. And a very similar logic applied in Sissel versus Health and Human Services, saying that since Congress explicitly stated this, this is how it should be followed. But the problem with that is if all of his rulings depend on specific congressional action or specific written out instructions in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights, it means that any interpretation, because the Constitution is a short but living document. It was never meant to spell out exactly what to do. It was supposed to be flexible, breathable. It was supposed to be interpreted to create a body of law, a canon of law that applied to the society that it served. And so for him to say, no, if it's not in there explicitly, it's not a thing. That's just not how this is going to work. And for so many reasons, and I will still never, ever get over sentient, uncircumcised penis Mitch McConnell stealing a Supreme Court seat, Kavanaugh's appointment to the SCOTUS bench would create a very conservative ideology on the bench that would go on for decades, for generations. So call your senator. It is time for them to put up or shut up on this one. We shouldn't be not voting on a nominee at all. And if we have to, we have to block this asshole. We've said it before. Collins and Murkowski, don't call them unless you are their direct constituents. But call your own senators. Get involved. Understand what the strategy is. And make sure that this guy, who, like I said, looks like the most boring asshole on the planet, is actually creating shit policies wrapped in dull enough language to make sure the American people don't notice. And that is absolutely not okay. The hellion this week is actually a couple weeks old. Her name is Patricia Akumo, and she is an immigrant from the Congo and is now a naturalized citizen. And I'm going to call back to this. I'm going to stick a pin in that and come back to it. But on July 4th, so 4th of July, she climbed the Statue of Liberty to protest the kids being held in cages at the border. She said, quote, "I was thinking of Lady Liberty above me. You are so huge. You have always been a symbol of welcome to people arriving in America. And now for me, under this sandal, she is shelter." She went on, "I felt peaceful that I was with those children in spirit. I could feel their isolation and their cries being answered only by four walls." And this is a woman who wanted to make a statement. And she said that she didn't care what happened to her. She is an immigrant, naturalized citizen, woman of color who put her body on the line to protest these horrific policies. She said that she was inspired by Michelle Obama's famous quote, "When they go low, we go high." And she said, quote, "I went as high as I could." So it is this sort of activism that sometimes activism is protesting in the street. Sometimes activism is calling your senators. Sometimes activism is writing a letter or, you know, going to an interview or working on policy or some of those things. But sometimes activism is making a sharp visual statement and forcing people to listen to what you have to say, even if it means it's dangerous, even if it means you're breaking the law. And this is also something I want to come back to. So I said that she was a naturalized citizen and she clearly broke the law. And Varsha and I talked about this, I believe, on Monday, if not last week, but the Trump administration is creating a denaturalization task force. So it just really concerns me because is this the sort of thing that she could be, quote, flagged for? So is this enough to revoke her citizenship? Because we heard about that woman who was flagged because of her involvement in a fraud scheme that she actually ended up turning state's evidence for. So this, again, wider context, this is why these sort of policies matter. Because it's never just about one fraud case that results in a denaturalization of a citizen. It's about the fear of all naturalized citizens that they, how dare you speak out of turn or how dare you protest? And I worry that in this sort of day and age, that that sort of protest is going to come under fire in this denaturalization task force. So Patricia Akumo, you are a badass hellion. Thank you for making that loud and public statement. Thank you for putting your body on the line. And, you know, I hope at the very least it made people listen. There are children still being held in cages at the border. There are 3,000 children that have been separated from their parents. And you know what? Side note, the Trump administration has not met the deadlines that the judge ordered to reunify the children with their parents. Something like 4 out of 105 babies and toddlers have been reunited, and the deadline was Monday. So this is definitely something we're going to keep looking at. And it takes women like Patricia Akumo to do so. And we thank her.
Destiny Lopez is the co-director of All Above All, a group focused on lifting restrictions on abortions and restoring insurance coverage for abortion so all women, regardless of income, has access to this medical procedure. Destiny has worked for Planned Parenthood, Access Women's Health Justice, and NARAL Pro-Choice New York. So thank you so much, Destiny, for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So to start off, can you tell us a little bit about All Above All?
Sure. All Above All is a campaign of over 100 organizations and thousands of people across the country that are committed to lifting abortion coverage bans like the Hyde Amendment. So the Hyde Amendment has, for over the last 40 years, denied low-income women who are enrolled in Medicaid access to abortion. And so we are really centered on lifting up the voices of women of color, young women, immigrants, kind of the folks who are most impacted by abortion coverage bans, and doing advocacy and organizing to ensure that we can lift those bans and expand access.
Right. I want to actually jump right on something that you said with the Hyde Amendment. And today, I really want to talk about Brett Kavanaugh as Trump's Supreme Court nominee and what that means for Roe v. Wade and abortion access going forward. So I think one of the most salient recent opinions was his dissenting opinion in Garza versus Hargan, which was the case the ACLU brought against HHS that for trying to block a young undocumented immigrant from getting an abortion. So in his dissent, it seems like what he was trying to argue was that the issue was not about abortion, but about the government facilitating an abortion versus having this young undocumented teen go to a sponsor and having them facilitate the abortion. Is that correct?
That's the argument, and I would disagree with that analysis that he had, but yes, that was the argument that he made.
That he made, right. Okay, so that's the one that he made. So what do you think the argument that he was making was?
So I think essentially he was saying that the government couldn't provide any supports to this young woman to access abortion care. And what we know the reality was, the young woman had all the support she needed in place. She had secured funding to get the procedure. She had secured, you know, a place to actually go to get the procedure. Like, the folks who are around her supporting her, her lawyers and others, had put everything in place for her to get the procedure. The only thing missing was the government literally allowing her to leave the facility to go and get the procedure. And that essentially was the crux of the argument. Right. There's nothing in law that says that the government is allowed to do that, right? Like, we know with the Hyde Amendment, for example, that Congress currently denies the ability to fund abortions for young women like that young woman. But that's all that the law says. And the law, by the way, is voted on annually, so we could change it in any moment. But but that's all that the law says. And so essentially that argument just fell flat because the young woman had done everything in her power to ensure that the government had to do very little actually to get her to the care that she has the right to.
Right. Yeah. She wasn't asking anything of the government except to leave the facility to go.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
So with this case and this sort of being a lightning rod for Kavanaugh, are there any other opinions that he's written about abortion or abortion access specifically that worry you and those seeking to protect abortion rights?
Yeah, there's a couple of other things I would note beyond the Jane Doe case of that young immigrant woman. So we know that he's publicly, it's not a ruling necessarily, but we can look to other things he's done in the public sphere to maybe indicate how he would rule in the court. So he's, for example, praised Chief Justice Rehnquist's dissent in Roe v. Wade, joining in criticizing rights such as abortion that are not specifically enumerated in the text of the Bill of Rights. So, you know, that public praise might give us some clues as to how he would rule. He's done some things around, I mean, I think we can't look at abortion in isolation. While that's important, I think we always look at abortion, we look at family planning, we look at healthcare, access to healthcare. And if we look at just those three issues, he's voted to allow a boss's religious beliefs to override an individual's right to insurance coverage of birth control. So not abortion people, birth control. And he's argued in favor of a claim that the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional. And in terms of thinking about access to reproductive health care for women of reproductive age, the Affordable Care Act provides innumerable benefits to some of the most marginalized women in our society. So I think when we take that as a whole, it's not looking good for women in particular or folks who need access to reproductive health care, certainly including abortion.
Yeah, I definitely agree that the Affordable Care Act rulings are deeply linked. Like you said, this is all one issue with many different roots. So I want to ask you, though, if, you know, a lot of the discussion with Trump getting a second SCOTUS nominee is that it would be the death of Roe v. Wade. And again, I don't know enough about the Supreme Court in my day-to-day life to make a judgment on that. But from what I'm reading, it seems more like Kavanaugh would be interested in making it difficult to get an abortion rather than going after Roe v. Wade itself. What do you think? Do you think that that Roe v. Wade is in peril, or it's just going to be these laws that make it so difficult?
You know, I think frankly, in either scenario, it's going to be bad. And why I think that is that for a certain group of women in this country, low-income women, women of color in particular, Roe is essentially already out of reach, right? So it might still exist in law, but we already know what it would look like if Roe falls. So sure, he could go after Roe. What might be just as likely is instead there are a series of cases that come that just further erode abortion access around a variety of issues that anti-choice folks have been trying to move in the states for years and years. So in either scenario, to be frank, there is going to be less access to abortion to make it almost impossible to get an abortion in this country. And for a good, you know, a decent subset of women right now, today, that is already the case. And so to me, it is in some ways less about whether it's Roe that falls or all of these other bad bills that are coming up through the courts that get that the court then addresses and sides with anti-choice folks on. Either way, you are going to see an erosion of abortion access that we haven't seen in many decades, but that certainly we are already beginning to see the impact of in places like Texas and in states where there's only one clinic, right, in the whole state. And that's, you know, a handful of states. So we already know what that impact is going to look like. In some ways, we're sounding the siren on abortion access writ large. Regardless of the way it gets there, this court with Kavanaugh on that bench will now move toward a future with incredibly limited access to abortion. And I think that's, to me, that's the most important thing to convey to your listeners today.
Right. So you said that already Roe is out of reach for low-income women and women of color. What are the biggest barriers that women of color and low-income women have to getting an abortion? So how is Roe already out of reach? And what systematically is in place?
So there are all sorts of restrictions on everything from how far along in her pregnancy a woman can access abortion care. Because of the limited number of abortion providers that exist in the country, we now have what we call abortion deserts, which means that there, you know, it's more than 500 miles to your nearest abortion provider. So if you think about what that looks like practically for a woman, it means that you're likely going to need to take time off work. You're going to need a car. You're going to need money to get yourself there. You might need money to stay overnight. You're going to have to find childcare. So when you think about just that idea of the distance the provider is from where you live, that presents a whole host of challenges. But then there's also things like waiting periods, right, that then start that domino effect of those same types of challenges. The allowance of fake clinics to exist where women go thinking they're going to be able to get abortion care and instead they're delayed with all these kind of tactics around offering fake medical advice. So there's like a number of these barriers that are in place that frankly at this point are too far to mention. And it's everything just shy of outlawing abortion. But really what we know in practice is it is as if abortion has been outlawed for that group of women.
So because of this, you know, the Guttmacher Institute had a study about abortion and basically who gets them and why. And they found that Black and Latina women were more likely to experience unintended pregnancy than white women and were disproportionately likely to need medical care. And then also 3/4 of abortion patients were low income, with half living at less than the federal poverty line. So this is obviously very much an issue of race and class. So do you think that is playing into these discussions that we're having around Kavanaugh? Obviously, this is a very sensitive subject, but it is particularly, you know, like you said, Roe is out of reach for these women already. So do you think that's playing into this discussion at all?
I don't think it's playing into it enough, frankly. And that's something that all above all, because we center these constituencies, low-income women, women of color, in, you know, in our campaign, we really want to bring this to the fore. It's why I talk so much about it. I think that, you know, likely, I don't know much about you, but I would imagine that you could probably figure out everything you would need if you needed to access an abortion if it were to be outlawed or severely restricted where you live.
Absolutely.
Right. And so I'm a Latina, so I identify as a woman of color, but I'm a Latina who has enough economic stability where I would probably be able to figure it out too. But there is a whole class of women where that is just not going to be the case. So not only are they going to be impacted by a Kavanaugh nomination because of that, but if we look at kind of the way the court ruled even in the last kind of week of its decision, decisions and what then another conservative justice would do, it is the same groups of women that will be impacted. So if you look at something like a Muslim ban, right? So immigrant women are already disproportionately impacted by abortion access. You know, they're going to get that double whammy of not being able to be connected with their families. Workers, you know, we had a big ruling around unions. Workers are disproportionately women of reproductive age in this country who are members of unions. And so they were, you know, again, this like double impact. So we like to look at it holistically so that these women, you know, are facing multiple barriers, not just in access to abortion, but in other parts of their lives. And all of those contribute, lack of health insurance, et cetera, to their ability to access care in an equal way to their white or more wealthy counterpart. And, you know, and we've heard this and seen this in case law over and over again. I mean, if I think about the issue we work on, the Hyde Amendment, you know, Henry Hyde, when he instituted it, said, look, I would ban abortions for every woman if I could, but I only have control over Medicaid. And so that's where I'm going to start my work. Well, that means that you're going after low-income women. And in this case, any erosion of Roe or abortion access means that you're essentially going after low-income women and women of color.
So with all of that, what are some of the tactics that you're using and that other people can potentially employ to not just fight Kavanaugh, but to put Roe in reach for all women? So that you said that the Hyde Amendment is voted on every year. Are there campaigns to get people to vote against the Hyde Amendment? What are some of the things that would immediately alleviate some of this disparity in who has access to abortion?
Yeah, so I think it's a couple of things. So one, I think on the federal level, we exist in part to work on the federal level to get rid of Hyde. And so we have a bill in Congress called the Each Woman Act that Barbara Lee, out of the great state of California, she sponsors, along with over 130 other members of Congress, that would essentially eliminate Hyde. We are still pushing on the Senate to introduce a similar bill. And then obviously we're going to need a very different Congress, a very different administration in place to really move that bill. But we have to start having a vision for what we want the world to look like out there now. And so the bill is really important. There are two other things that I would say that folks need to do. They have to really follow what's happening in their states, because what we know is that many states, if they were allowed, would ban abortion immediately if Roe were to fall. And again, this erosion is already happening. In the first quarter of 2018 alone, 37 states introduced 308 new abortion restrictions. So not all of those have passed into law, but that volume is outrageous. And so folks really need to pay attention to what's happening in their state. And then that's connected to who are they voting into office. So it's not lost on us, I think, about the timing of this nomination and that it's going to be rushed through before the midterm elections. But those elections are key. I mean, you can draw a direct connection to the senators who you get to vote for in midterms and presidential year elections, and their ability to either nominate, either pass a nomination or deny a nomination to the court. And so the elections become incredibly important. And so right now, what I think we need to tell folks to do is, one, you know, let your senator know if you don't support Kavanaugh getting nominated to the bench, you need to let them know that they need to stop this. But you also simultaneously need to be engaged in what's happening on the state level, and certainly you need to be voting in midterms.
Speaking of letting your senators know, there's been a lot of talk about Collins and Murkowski. They are they're pro-choice women Republicans, as far as I can tell. Do you think that Collins and Murkowski are interested enough in this issue to possibly make this difficult for Kavanaugh or even vote against him?
I do. I think that they have shown that in the past, that they have certainly on other legislative issues, on other nominations, they have certainly been the turning points for whether noms actually go through or not, whether legislation goes through or not, particularly around issues of reproductive health access and abortion care. I don't think they're going to be motivated to do it, though, unless they hear from their constituents. Right. And so I think that that's going to be key. The signs aren't good thus far. But again, I think we've been in this position with them before where, you know, either we're not getting a sign of how they're going to vote, or the signs have not been good. And we then have to put that pressure on them from their district or their state in this case to ensure that they understand that their constituents, like 7 in 10 Americans, are, you know, support a woman's right to choose. And therefore, that Kavanaugh would be bad for the court.
Right. I want to ask you a completely wild, speculative question. I try to ask everyone I talk to about this. I don't understand why this is such a hot button issue, you know, healthcare and abortion care particularly. But why does abortion care light people's hair on fire?
It's a great question, particularly because a substantial majority of people in the U.S., as I just said, 7 in 10 believe abortion should remain legal, and majority also support our issue insurance coverage for it. So, you know, I think in some cases, it's perhaps our opposition has a bigger megaphone than we do and has just been louder about it than we have. The media picks up on that and runs with it. I also think, look, this is a up until the last maybe 3 to 5 years, we haven't heard a lot from, nor should we have, but I'm glad that we do, from women who have had abortions, right? So it's this issue that is talked a lot about politically, but wasn't really talked about on a personal level, and what women experiences are and who are the women who are having the abortions or the people who are having abortions. And so I think, you know, without that counter narrative, I think sometimes it can be hard to move past the political kind of rigmarole around it. And so I think, you know, unless we actually know and put a name to a face of who, you know, who the face of abortion is in this country, I think it can be harder for folks to then be willing to have a different conversation about that. I'm hopeful that that is changing, given the number of stories we're seeing about it in magazines and pop culture. But I do wonder whether that has had some impact.
Do you think that having more women of color and low-income women come forward with their stories about abortion would shift the needle at all?
One of the things I actually have observed is that women of color in particular have been at the forefront of leading this charge to have abortion stories out there. We have a really great organization called We Testify that's part of the National Network of Abortion Funds that is committed to getting the stories and voices of women of color in the media, storylines on TV, women talking, you know, penning op-eds, women talking to reporters. And I think that knowing that our stories as women of color are unique in this space because of the barriers we face around language, culture, economics, I think that it has been imperative on us to kind of lead the way on that. And I think that we're doing it. Do I think more could be helpful? Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, Destiny, thank you so much for talking to me about this very important issue. And I hope that we don't have a Judge Kavanaugh on the bench of SCOTUS.
So do I. And I hope that all your listeners will do everything they can to prevent it. I know that at All Above All, we are doing that. And that is our charge in this moment.
Yep. All hands on deck. So thank you again. And you can follow All Above All on Twitter at All Above All. So thank you, Destiny. Thank you so much for the good work that you're doing.
Thanks again for giving us a platform to talk more about this issue.
Of course. All right. Bye-bye. All right, Hellions, that is it for me. I hope you enjoyed Destiny Lopez as much as I did. Like she said, please call your senators. Stay on top of this. This is something that's very important. Brett Kavanaugh is not just going to go away. We need to make him go away. I also want to remind everyone there will be no shows next week as I will be at Comic-Con. If any of you Hellions are also nerds like me, I will be in San Diego. So please feel free to hit me up on Twitter or Facebook and maybe we can do a Hellion meetup. So not next week, but until the week after, Hellions, raise some hell and practice your empathy, because we all need to be a little bit nicer, just not to Sarah Huckabee Sanders.